Sean, to start this conversation, what is painting?
What is painting?
Yeah.
Arguably as old as human civilization, if one goes back to evidence of cave paintings across, you know, the world, not just the African continent. It's a statement of belief. It's very sensory, even though you're not allowed to touch. You know, painting is something that you can touch with your eyes. It's a very rich experience.
Something you can touch with your eyes. That's an interesting way to put it.
Welcome to Jude's List, the podcast. In this series, we're delving into the dynamic world of art and culture with a focus on the Investec Cape Town Art Fair. Now in its 11th edition, this annual event held at the Cape Town International Convention Center features over 100 galleries and showcases the incredible works of more than 500 artists across four continents. Join us as we explore the curated series, highlighting the diverse and innovative expressions of creativity that makes this fair a standout on the global art calendar. This is Jude, and I'm excited to take you on an exclusive journey through the Investec Art Fair curated series. In today's episode, we are thrilled to welcome Sean O'Toole, Cape Town-based journalist and writer, formerly editor of Art South Africa, a quarterly print magazine focusing on contemporary South African and African art. He also writes a weekly column on photography for the Sunday Times and a bi-weekly art column for the Financial Mail. Sean is the curator for the upcoming solo section of the fair.
Welcome, Sean. Thank you for joining me today. I'm thrilled to have you join us.
Thanks.
Looking forward to an exciting conversation.
No pressure.
Yes, yes. Sean, let's start off by talking about your early career as a journalist and how you got started working in the art world.
I entered the art world and journalism fairly obliquely. I did 2 degrees. I did English literature and law, and then I did a proper postgraduate law school degree. And during my 20s, I worked in the corporate world. And by age 29, 30, sort of looked for the eject button. And so I started freelancing rather than what most journalists would do, which would be a kind of internship and junior reporting. Freelancing then, as it is now, is quite perilous. So I kind of moved between reportage and writing about friends who were mainly artists. And that was my track throughout much of the early 2000s. I worked as a journalist at the Sunday Times in South Africa, which is the largest weekend paper. So I would do from political profiles through to writing. I had a column for 6 years about South African contemporary photography. So, you know, it was big picture stuff and then sort of focusing on the art world. During that time, also, I became editor of a specialist print magazine called Art South Africa, which was reborn as Art Africa after I left. And so I suppose I held all these different jobs in a kind of strange equilibrium. But from around 2010 onwards till today, I've principally written about the visual art.
Okay. And what sort of drove your interest towards the arts?
I mean, there were various reasons. Some were just friendships. A lot of my friends either studied graphic design or fine art, and their parties were always more fun when we were younger, and just sort of interesting conversations. I suppose I was, as I still am, a very big music fan, and there's so much overlap between music and art. You know, album covers, band names, that drove me to, back then, pre-Wikipedia, to encyclopedias to try understand the name of the band. And you'd always find, well, not always, but you'd often find a reference to the art world. It was a place that I was curious and interested about. I suppose journalism allowed me to pursue it further.
Yeah. And Sean, on your current work with the Investec Cape Town Art Fair 2024, how did you get in touch with the fair? And what is your role for the upcoming fair?
Worked the other way around. They got in touch with me shortly before the pandemic, probably in 2018-19. I was a little frustrated with the nature of journalism, which is very promiscuous. You're jumping from idea to idea. You fall in love with the story of an artist for a brief period, and then you move on. It's very deadline-driven. There's a high churn involved. And I'd wanted to do more settled writing, writing where you can think more deeply around either an idea or an artist or a particular work. And it always struck me that there were these wonderful catalogs that accompanied big exhibitions. So in my naivety, I thought, well, let me give curating a bash because I can sort of settle on certain ideas and maybe then it'll produce writing. In 2021, I curated an exhibition at Norval Foundation in Cape Town, which looked at the kind of longer history of black figurative painting in South Africa. So it focused on an early pioneer, George Pemba, and then Trevor Makoba and Setombiso Sibisi. And shortly after that, I did an exhibition, which was a historical survey of the photo book in South Africa. The photo book being a book principally made up of photographs. I think they were ambitious. They didn't produce any catalogs, but I suppose people not knowing that I curated in the early 2000s, I did an exhibition around the representations of Nelson Mandela by artists and graphic designers in 2004. I also did an exhibition around contemporary fashion photography in 2003. But, you know, the art world's memory is only about 2 years. So I was seen as a, I suppose, a novice curator. And the art fair approached me to curate the solo section for the 2023 art fair edition. And so this is my second year doing it for 2024.
Okay. So what was the experience like in 2023? What was your takeaways from that experience as a curator?
I think being a little older, I'm not doing it at age 25 or 32. I am aware that the art fair is a commercial platform. And one can bring museum grade or project space grade ideas to an art fair, but it's not necessarily going to work because an art fair is exactly what its name suggests. It's a place where art is traded. And so what one's creating, I suppose, is a light armature to hold a set of ideas and artists. So even though I was mindful of that, I think I was a little overambitious in my first year in that I wanted to have an exhibition that looked at the correspondence between drawing and photography. You know, there's been a lot of exhibitions about the relationship, and it's an obvious one, between drawing and painting, but less so drawing and photography. It was a nice idea in retrospect, but there's a certain pragmatics to the art market. And one of those sort of pragmatisms after 2020, at least, was photography had fallen by the wayside as a collectible. There was a huge turn to painting, partly as a sort of defensive act on the one hand, but also through, I suppose, one might say, social justice and interest and emergent younger black artists, particularly working in a figurative idiom. So the idea of showing photography especially didn't really work. We had a photographer. I thought his work was astonishing, but it didn't manage to sell. And drawing, as we know, is a very low price point. And the art fair is not a table that you just come put your wares out. It's a space that you hire at great expense. And typically, there's a lot of logistics behind it. So it worked, but I realized one needs a far more pragmatic framework for the fair. So hence in 2024, the decision to look at painting.
Okay. I know you're working with the solo section. What can we expect to see? And what is the theme that you're focusing on for this section?
In broad terms, it's painting. So I'm not really drawing a distinction between figurative or abstract. What I am interested in is work that maybe calls itself painting, but doesn't necessarily always present as painting. We'll have an Iranian-born artist who's living in Cape Town, Kamya Binistareg, who tends to make these large... Well, he just recently had a solo exhibition in Cape Town. So it was very large, when I'm talking about 3 to 5 meters across by 2 meters up. Wall relief.
That's big.
That's very big. So I don't know. We'll see what compromises are made for the fair. But he uses glue and he takes these impressions off walls. Is it painting? If the artist calls it painting, I would accept it. And, you know, that's the kind of work I'm interested in. There's another artist whose name just for the moment escapes my mind, who's showing textile work. But the work is informed by her painting practice. So, you know, it's that kind of idea that painting can operate like drawing, that it can be the first draft that you can roll out across other medium. It doesn't have to be the final destination, you know, because... Typically, one thinks of drawing or photography as the rough sketches for painting. But sometimes, you know, a painting in the sense of like a watercolor or gouache can be a draft towards a sculpture, or in this case, towards textile works. Arguably as old as human civilization, if one goes back to evidence of cave paintings across, you know, the world, not just the African continent.
What is painting?
I suppose, unlike digital technologies, which tend to operate in a more cinematic way, in the sense that it requires more than one person to do it, partly because some of the value chain is sort of broken up, painting is still a very singular statement, and it's a very intimate sort of conversation with one person and their worldview, their idea of what an image looks like, how to experience very primal things like form and color. And that's the joy of painting. Painting,
yes.
Unlike digital production, which can be very Fordist, is singular, and it's a statement that typically gets made in isolation. It's a statement of belief, and it manifests in a very material way. But it, you know, as a viewer, you encounter color, form, material. It's very sensory, even though you're not allowed to touch. You know, painting, more so perhaps than our digital experience, is something that you can touch with your eyes. It's a very rich experience.
Something you can touch with your eyes. that's an interesting way to put it. Okay. And for this section, how do you define the experience that you want people to have, to feel whilst they're there?
I suppose there's two answers. There's the official art fair answer. You should feel delight and motivation enough to purchase the work. You know, bearing in mind it is an art fair, it's not a museum. But, you know, by the same token, art fairs, and I suppose particularly on the African continent, where museum culture and even alternative spaces to commercial galleries are so few and far between. Art fairs have sort of filled a gap that the Biennale project hasn't entirely managed to sustain. If I think in South Africa, there was two Biennales in Joburg in the late 90s. There was an attempt in Cape Town in the early 2000s. Didn't work out yet. We have...
Why is that?
Why did they not succeed?
Yeah.
I suppose it's a question that, you know, we could thrash out together, but the museum, particularly in a Western sense, has a long history. And it would, I suppose its origins certainly go back to, if one looks at, say, something like the Louvre in Paris, goes back to Napoleonic times. So you've got more than two centuries of a kind of introduction to a project that will refine itself over time. It's, you know, one can't open up an exhibition, a museum on the African continent and believe it will be immediately successful. And, you know, I think the Biennale project, as I understand it, was an expansion as well as a rejection of the museum concept. But by the time it sort of landed in what is the oldest in Senegal, Dakar, and then various manifestations like in Bamako, the photography biennial, you know, both of those predate the ones in South Africa. So the Johannesburg opens in 95, the first Johannesburg Biennale, a year after non-racial democracy, the achievement of in South Africa. But arguably, trading in high-minded ideas, fairly sophisticated artists working with, let's say, post-painterly ideas. You know, if I recall, if I go back to Joburg 95, there was huge anticipation in the arts community, but very little broad buy-in from the public.
Yeah.
To the extent that Okwi and Wiesel's edition, which was 97, was very critically important. If you look at the catalogue, has marvelous essays, but closed a month early due to singular lack of public interest. The art fairs, strangely enough, have managed to kind of broker a public and speak to a larger base, partly because, I guess, of the financial imperative. They have to place work in front of a public that will sell. It's not about selling, always at least, sophisticated ideas. And so you're narrowing that distance with the public. I don't know if that is too academic an answer. I don't think so. What do you
think? I don't think so. Because I feel like in the sense of how the fair creates access, this also creates access to absorbing it in such a way that wouldn't necessarily be traditional. This then bridges the gap for people to plug in, for people to play, for people to appreciate what is happening on the continent,
sure,
especially in Cape Town during this time.
Yeah, and I think increasingly there's a lot of activity happening in West Africa, which is encouraging, so that you have these multiple sites of not only commerce, but sort of a kind of meaning making. And you disrupt this idea of like singularity. Yes. I mean, I think so many of us that live on the continent are bored by always being spoken of as a kind of unity.
Yes, yes. And it's also interesting to see how at the same time, there's also a separateness that you experience like once you get to travel on the continent. Because for my first time being in South Africa, I had a very strange experience where...
Where were you?
I was in Pretoria.
Well, that would be strange. I'm from there, so...
Yeah, I had a very strange experience, Sean. And this is me having a conversation with someone at the mall, and then they decided to speak in Zulu. And My reaction is just a blank stare because obviously I didn't understand the language. And then they asked me, oh, so where are you from? And I said, oh, I'm from Ghana. And the lady said to me, oh, so you're from Africa? And that blew my mind. I was like, what? So I didn't know how to like accept or challenge that statement. But I also understood that that is the divide that we have on the continent, where we also don't know exactly how we are close at the same time we are separated. And it's sort of like the unfolding story, which is now told in such democratized ways that now people are having, for the very first time, the opportunity to travel to different parts of Africa, you know, for the first time, like to meet different people. So it's interesting that also this platform being created is bringing people all over from the continent to interact in such a way, you know. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, listening to you speak, I'm reminded I lived in Japan for 2 years, and Japan is definitely not like South Africa, and Japan is definitely also not like Nigeria, which Teju Cole writes about in Open City. He says the Nigerians are like the Japanese. I disagree. The Japanese have that same ambiguous relationship that the British have to Europe, the Japanese have to Asia. And even though we're not an island, South Africa somehow, through its terrible history, has become, or was at least, an island. And the strange thing, you know, even if one looks at sort of the deeper cultural histories here, the South African jazz, which is such a huge export globally,
it's
hugely informed by particularly black metropolitan South Africa's love affair with Manhattan, you know, and not high life West Africa at the same time. And you see lots of examples of that. If you look at our painting history, it's a very European-influenced painting history, very much informed by the revolutions in Paris and Berlin, to a degree London too. So, you know, when artists like Gerard Sokoto or Ernst Mancoba decide to go into exile, they go to Paris, not to Dakar or Tulane. Yeah. You know, that said, a lot of the political resistance took up home in various parts of Southern Africa, parts of West Africa. You know, there's been recovery projects. I think Chimurenga Mtone Jaben, the Chimurenga Massive, did that book on Festac, which was the Pan-African Festival. There was one, I think, in Dakar and then one in Lagos. And you see a lot of Pan-African exchange. I think the art fair isn't remotely the same. You know, it's a very singular media that it focuses on, at least. Or
yes,
it's not an arts festival. It doesn't have music and all of that. It's very much driven by a particular imperative, which is fine. But it's important to, I suppose, what we're talking about is connections and disconnections. And the art fair has the capacity to connect. But, you know, I mean, I remember an artist once telling me, an Angolan artist, no one travels in Africa except businessmen and politicians. And arguably, it's true. I mean, if you know, to come from Ghana to South Africa, it is relatively simple, but it's a six-hour flight, sometimes longer. I know from friends, even myself, if you participate, let's say you get invited to the Bamako Biennale, some people will fly from Johannesburg to Paris and then back down. You know, it's not an easy moving around on the continent. So there's certain, I suppose, transport and logistics issues that maintain the separateness, never mind the distance. You know, there was a project I loved years ago where a group of Lagosian photographers decided to drive to Bamako to participate in the Biennale. And I think Emmanuel Iduma was even involved, the writer. And It took them some ridiculous time. They crossed about 7 countries. They went up at the borders. And you think, gosh, I mean, Lagos to Bamako, if you draw a line on a map, isn't very far. But just the difficulties. So you can imagine, compound that, if you're an ambitious artist, let's say in Kinshasa, and want to connect with the Cape Town Art Fair. Oh, God, you have, firstly, like, passport problems, and then flight issues. It's never easy. I think, if I had to condense that, it's always good to check one's idealism and enthusiasm, but at the same time, to maintain it as a kind of goal.
Yeah. And talking about the fair again, I know the upcoming fair has a theme on bound. Mm-hmm. How does the solo section feed into that theme?
Very loosely. As I mentioned earlier, I'm interested in painting, but I'm really interested in where painting sort of comes undone and becomes something else, where it might invite, you know, collage, where people put elements in, so it becomes both photographic and sculptural. And so I'm taking it, the unbound theme, to sort of unravel painting a little bit, as much as is possible. I've seen some of the entries, and they will be very composed. They'll be framed.
Yeah.
And there'll be oil on canvas. It's propositional too. I think one forgets that, unlike last year, earlier this year, the 23 edition, the solo booths were all dotted across the fair. That was very much an atomized presentation. So for 24, we are putting them in a solo section together, like physically together. And in that difference, I think some of the conversations will emerge, where painting becomes, you know, I don't want to be too instrumental about the theme, but where one can see its edges, a little bit of its unraveling, maybe its unbinding.
Yeah, yeah. Sean, can you also talk about the artists featured in this section? Who are some of the artists that we can expect to see in the upcoming fair?
So from What If the World Gallery, which is based in Cape Town, we have Maya Marks, who is an established painter in her 40s, paints in a very particular, sort of almost pointless, meticulous style. If one hastily sees the work, it looks abstract, but it often has a kind of reference that's submerged in the work. She's a fantastic painter, very rigorous. There's also another Cape Town gallery, Ebony, curated. We'll have Aniko Mostert, who has these sort of attenuated long figures. I saw her work earlier this year in Chicago. The wonderful thing when painting travels is unexpected conversations happen. And Ebony took some of her works to Expo Chicago. And Chicagoans immediately started comparing her to a local painter from the early 20th century who was friends with a lot of the early jazz musicians, Duke Ellington, etc. And I went into the Art Institute of Chicago to have a look. They had a work of hers, and it's like, I can see why.
Okay. 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 Back to your point in the relationship between what the people in Chicago saw with this artist. Did you also see that similarity? And what was the significance of their style in today's era and or today's time?
I suppose one doesn't want to overemphasize it, but I think the idea of originality, while important, is sometimes overemphasized. And work can unwittingly carry echoes of things that have happened before. Aniko had never heard of the artist that she was compared to. Yet when you saw it, you could see certain formal relationships. And I suppose that's a happy accident. You can, I suppose, if one, you know, this isn't someone who's on my show or on the solo section, Blessing Ngubeni, if one looks at his work, one can see echoes of Picasso. I don't know how closely necessarily he's looking at works like Guernica and that. But, you know, when one makes an image, it exists within a large sea of images, and there will be likenesses that or correspondences.
Yeah, I think that's the essence of art as well. It's supposed to also depict the times. So we're moving through cycles. So some of these stories are bound to be told in different ways. Sure. And in different mediums by some of these artists. So that could be the relationship there that is being highlighted.
I hope so. Could be.
So is there anything you also want to highlight specifically for your section, Sean?
I'm thinking, you know, I could mention a couple of painters. You know, I think Maya, whom I mentioned earlier, is one of the older artists. And if Maya's listening, I apologize for calling you old. 40 something is definitely not old, but it's always exciting to see young artists. And I think, you know, that's what an art fair is good at, is testing the waters, you know, taking a barometer read with a young artist. There's a gallery from Johannesburg called Guns and Rain, and they're going to be showing a young painter, Adrian Fortein. And I saw his work a few months ago. Colleagues said he was clearly looking at I think he's American or Canadian, Peter Doig, who lives in London. I guess if one wanted to make the comparison. But he was painting large canvases, fairly imaginative, maybe dreamscapes. But what was interesting was seeing some of the work that he'd painted earlier in the year. And if people were seeing Peter Doig circa 2 months ago, I was seeing Philip Guston from works earlier in the year. So why do I say this? What I like about young artists is they change every 4 or 5 months. And, you know, there's that rapid prototyping of a career, if one wants to speak in sort of business terms. But it's wonderful to watch that and to see it, and just to maybe offer a platform that could capture a moment in time as they move on. I'm thinking another artist is Mangaliso Nzuza, who's going to be with showcased by THK Gallery. And I suppose, you know, I've mentioned a couple of names of likenesses, but cities have their own popular artists that sometimes don't travel beyond there. You know, if I think of Ghanaian painting, unavoidably, if one thinks of historical painting, there's, and now his name escapes me, but the huge market scenes and
Abladeglova.
Yes. And,
yes.
You know, that's someone who's well traveled, as in like his images, but I'm sure Accra also has its kind of favorite son who's less well known outside. And, you know, Peter Clark is an example of that in Cape Town, hugely revered in Cape Town. He passed away a few years ago. Remarkable artist, friends with so many important painters. He even struck up a correspondence with Langston Hughes, the great American poet, after he won a writing competition in the 50s. But Peter is sort of best known for his paintings. And I certainly think Mangaliso's figurative paintings come from the tradition of Peter Clark. I don't know if it's planned or not. I don't suspect that. There's just a certain sort of approach to the figure and a certain palette. And it's wonderful to see that, to see a kind of lineage in a painter. Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go through to everyone. So, you know, partly keep it a little.
Yes, yes. As a surprise for our listeners. Yeah, you mentioned something that I also want us to go back to on the critical element of why young artists evolve quickly now with their practice. They go through so much change. Why do you think that is, and how is that important for their work?
I suppose one of the luxuries with painting is that evolution is so baked into the life of being a painter. And if we take two sort of world famous artists that I've mentioned, Philip Guston or Picasso, they had so many different phases that they went through.
Yeah.
And, if I look more closely to home, Tsinga Samson, who's now represented by White Cube, a Cape Town-based painter, very well known, I guess, now internationally for these fairly dark figurative paintings of figures sort of submerged into either very luxuriant sort of garden settings or these big figurative ensembles of people in denims with no shirts by a beach front. If you see his early work, and when I say early work, we're talking 10 years ago, the precision with which he paints now was not evident then. He worked in a far more wild, expressive manner. And it was only around 2016, 15, 16, he had an exhibition at Blank, initially of these sort of strange, almost like Huguenot figures from Dutch painting, and some very darkly toned flower still lives. And then in 2016, he showed five self-portraits that are the sort of origin of his current style. And it was very quick between 2016 and I think 2018 at the Armory show, where the dealer told me when the doors opened, people ran to their booth.
Wow.
I suppose that's the flip side of what we're talking about. Once you achieve a measure of financial success, you are trapped in your style. So if you are young, enjoy that sort of skittering promiscuity where you're just jumping from one idea to the next and seeing, what works and what doesn't. By the same token, I don't think you ever leave what you do. If I take another painter who I would have liked to have on the exhibition, Lisa Bryce, she's a friend. She's represented by Tadeusz Rapak. Lisa started out as a painter in the early 90s, at a time where it was probably deeply unfashionable. By 94, 95 of the first Joburg Biennale, if you were a painter and you were under 30, it was a declaration of conservatism. So Lisa began to make installation and sculpture, became very successful off that, but then really tired and moved to London, started painting again and had a long wilderness period. It was only in around 2014-15 she had a show at a little project space in London that Doru Olowu saw. And he really liked it and included Lisa on an exhibition at the Camden Art Center. Okay, so that's a lot of history. What's my point? If you look at some of Lisa's current work, which is currently on show in Paris, you can see a return to some of the interests of her very early paintings of female subjects freed of the kind of male bondage. And I mean that in a more metaphorical sense. And if you have to compare the paintings from the early 90s to now, they don't look the same at all. But, there's certain sort of recurring themes that when you are young, you're probably circling. As you get older, they formalize themselves.
Yeah.
The other thing, if I may ask a question, I suppose South Africa has a fairly sophisticated art market, and I'm talking commercial market, in which painting has always played a very important role. So you have generations of artists, going back to at least the 20s, probably even earlier, that have had an audience and collectors. And it's not something that necessarily my solo booth will acknowledge, but it's almost a kind of foundation on which both the Cape Town Art Fair trades and any painter in South Africa. You do have a history, even if you don't want to be a part of it.
Okay. How do you think that history has changed over time, especially from the early 90s till now?
From the early 90s, I think. I suppose one thing I wrote recently, and I still work principally as a journalist, about three women painters. And what sort of struck me in writing about them is that painting had not, at least from South Africa, had not felt part of the kind of contemporary discourse. The last time that painting really felt contemporary was probably in the late 80s. It was, you know, if one goes to the 90s, you see the emergence of William Kentridge with film and his animated drawings, and there were sort of various experiments. If I think back to the galleries and the new galleries and that, there were all these different propositions. You know, I remember going to a gallery in 94 and an artist exhibiting his membership cards to every political party. It caused great outrage because he had joined every political party. But, I mean, the point was, is a vitrine with cards art? Many people would still debate that. I thought it was a fantastic work. But the point is that painting was so far from what was seen as important. And that, I think, it continued. If I think of the 2000s, the early 2000s, you see the emergence of Zanele Moholi, Peter Hugo, Mikhail Subotsky, the canonization of David Goldblatt, Roger Ballen traveling, Guy Tillam. You know, it was photography. And it was only in the sort of 2010s that you began to see young painters emerge, but still very much in the shadow of artists working in other media. But certainly by the end of the last decade, there were solid careers, young artists producing work. I've mentioned one, Tsenga Samson. Georgina Greatrix would be another example. She exhibited, I think, in about 2018 or 19 in Los Angeles with Amuake Boafe on a show that was, you know, now a work that was on that show by Boafe was the one that went to London and sold for that ridiculous amount. I think it was like 800,000, wasn't it?
So Amuake Boafe was from Ghana, by the way.
Yes.
Yes.
I mean, what's interesting is I traveled to Ghana in 2017, and I absolutely loved it. I thought Accra, the art scene, reminded me of Johannesburg in the 90s. There was an openness, an experimentation, rivalry, but collegiality, not quite the professionalism, which can often stifle innovation. That you find in South Africa, where you have a small but quite formalized art scene.
Yeah. It's interesting you mentioned that because obviously in 2023, new institutions and new spaces that have opened up recently to artists and residencies. But now most of these emerging artists in Ghana especially have opened up their own residencies, like Amuake Boafe and a few others. It's creating this, like he said, very open economic transformation for new artists to be seen and to be heard, where now they have the autonomy to also like get representation, also to have access to these spaces that traditionally they wouldn't be able to have access to. Because in 2017, there were only about two galleries that were working with artists, but now there's a plethora of them. It's rapidly changing in that sense. And not only are these artists from Ghana, but like they're from all over from West Africa who are also coming to have residencies in Ghana. Like, I met an artist from Egypt who's doing work here in Ghana at an outdoor residency. And it's fantastic to see that we're having this exchange all over Africa. So that's what I mean by like that the borders are now being opened, and it's wonderful to see.
I think also what's equally wonderful to see is there was a time in the 90s that I suppose South Africa was flavor of the month, and South African artists enjoyed a lot of visibility in European and North American exhibitions. But there was a certain sort of, let's call it tendency, that slipped in where South Africa became a kind of proxy for the whole continent. It was a particular kind of lazy curator that would fly to either Johannesburg and Cape Town, carefully select by race and gender a few artists, and then claim to have sort of covered the continent. What you see now more is that South Africa is even bypassed, and you know, I don't mind that. It's fantastic to see, you know, even certain sort of traditional routes being overlooked. And you know, if I think particularly of Accra, you know, Zora, Opoku, there's a number of artists that, when they decided to settle on the continent, went to Accra, not to Johannesburg or to Cape Town, where certain perhaps communication and behind-the-scenes logistics are easier. I think it's great. It's a healthy rivalry and competition that it sets up.
Yeah. Coming back to you working with the current artist for the solo section, Sean, what went into your decision to choose to work with these artists?
I suppose it's, you know, not try obfuscate things. So as a curator, there's a certain sort of expectation. So the one is to develop a concept, which then one puts out as a public call to galleries, not to artists. So, you know, it's an important thing for someone who's not familiar with how art fairs necessarily work. In an enterprising artist can't apply in their own name. It has to be a gallery with a program. There would be a proposal, I would put out an idea that relates to the overall theme of Unbound. And this year it focuses on painting. If galleries feel there's something, they can apply. That's one, a very orthodox route. At the same time, I go out and reach out to specific artists and galleries and ask, would you like to present work? And, you know, there's obviously a calculus that happens. It's usually financial. Can a gallery afford? So for a smaller gallery, for example, they may decide, well, let's do a solo show, bet all our money on one artist, and not take a booth in the main section because they can't afford to do both. You know, and it is an important aspect to flag. You know, we're trading on a continent where economies are emerging. They're not mature. And that, you know, that applies in the art world too. There's a lot of startups that are independently funded. So they have to take those factors into account. So, yes, I put out a proposal which then galleries can respond to, but at the same time, I'd approached various artists and galleries directly. Again, something that's important and I suppose sensitive to flag is that it would be nice if certain big brand name artists from big brand name galleries showed. You know, imagine... you know, it's just blue sky thinking. Kerry James Marshall, Zwerner, or Oscar Murillo, who's more realistic. You know, he showed at Zeitz Mocha. That elite tier of galleries have not tended to show at the Cape Town Art Fair. A few years ago, Perrotin, the well-known French gallery, showed once. You're probably wondering, what am I trying to say? I suppose, you know, it's important also to understand the Cape Town Art Fair is a regional art fair. And its echo or its resonances are strongest in South Africa, and they reverberate outwards from there. So there's obviously a strong South African representation. That's not necessarily a bias. It's more of a pragmatism. It's not that the overriding audience is foreign, like Art Basel or Frieze. It's a local buying market with overlap of interested foreign collectors. One also has to be responsive in that sense. You sound like you're taking notes there.
Yes. I was just taking notes there. Yeah. In terms of expectations for attendees, yes. What is the overall feeling we can expect to see at this coming fair?
Well, the thing that's exciting for me is that because it's a single medium, painting, the fact that they'll be shown together will mean the sum perhaps and hopefully will be larger than necessarily the 10 component parts. And that's when we'll see 10 booths of very good art paintings, but they'll also exist in conversation with one another unavoidably. And hopefully there'll be a sense of what contemporary painting from Southern Africa looks like. There's a gallery from Zimbabwe also doing a presentation, First Floor Gallery. So, and, you know, even if one thinks that South Africa and Zimbabwe are neighbors, their painting traditions are very different. You know, if one just thinks of all the artists that have emerged in the past 10 years in the wake of Meshack Musamvu showing at the Zimbabwe Pavilion, I think it was in the early 2010s, and then you've got Portia Zavahera and Gresham Naude. You know, I mean, there's so many like extraordinarily talented Zimbabwean painters, but they paint in a tradition that's very different to South Africa. It'll be largely an overview of contemporary painting from South Africa with a painter from Egypt and one from Zimbabwe. I think that's true to the mission of the fair. It's a solidly South African fair that is international in outlook.
Okay. Lastly, Sean, what do you consider as contemporary art, especially in 2023?
Let me phrase the question differently. Now and again, I get invited to polite dinners by collectors and people that are far wealthier than me. And they'll ask me, who's the most important artist? And, you know, I get kind of stuck on that. But I've said, you know, the one answer is just to look at the indices as you would do with commodity trading. And there's winning stocks. So you can look at who's selling at auction very well. You know, and if you go by that metric, there's a couple of painters. Singer Samson has, you know, sustained some extraordinary prices. Lisa Bryce, expatriate South African, is the most expensive living South African artist. She sold a work about two or three years ago at auction for, gosh, I think it was about $2.8 million. It's higher than William Kentridge has ever achieved. But is that the most important art? And that's not to dismiss the painters. I think often when we judge importance, we judge it retrospectively. It's much easier to look back to the 90s and say the Walkman was a really interesting portable. But at the time, it would just be, well, this is kind of a nice thing to put cassettes in. And, you know, I think certainly there's a generation of artists working with the digital and trying to sort of understand it. How do you make something that is immaterial, that exists in this space that we're talking in, and call it art? That's a real channel and challenge. I think it's a challenge because we're all native to this space. We're so used to looking at ourselves as kind of digital postage stamps, and people collectors are increasingly will buy off JPEGs and PDFs. So how do you make an artwork that is revolutionary, challenging, propulsive, that's going to be meaningful? I suppose if you set out to do that, you're going to fail. But there are artists working with the digital medium, working between the digital and the analog, between the virtual and the real. And they're not necessarily artists that are featuring on any financial indices. You know, if I think of Deneo Bopape, Bohosi Sekukuni, Tabita Rezare, Noland Oswald Dennis, you know, there's a very exciting generation of artists that are pushing, testing what art can be. Because is an animated GIF, does it have the potential to be art, or is it just a kind of jokey thing like the Pac-Man? I don't know. And that's, you know, that's where artists can always astonish you, because they can make an argument that something that you didn't think was art is art. You know, the classic case being Marcel Duchamp with the urinal. So what is the urinal of the digital age?
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't sound convinced.
No. I'm just trying to assess all that you just shared to see if you answered my question, but I think you did. I think you did.
I can answer what it's not. It's definitely not an NFT, but it's something adjacent, okay. Perhaps.
Now, I'm also processing whether I'm happy with that answer, but yeah. I think we got it. We got it.
I mean, maybe the question is, what do I love as art? And then, you know, there would be traditional things, but, you know, we don't only, I suppose, look at art purely as something you love, purely as a financial commodity, purely as a thinking object. You know, it's usually a mix of all of those. But, you know, I think we are in the period of transition, civilizational transition. Yeah, and the digital.
How so?
I think, you know, if one just thinks of how the digital has enabled possibilities, the conversation we're having as an example, I think artists are not very good with technology generally, new technology, but they're good at thinking obliquely with these things and using it in a way that's unexpected. And that's what I'm curious to see what happens. In terms of digital practices.
Okay. And how do you think that's going to shape the narrative of the art industry moving forward, especially on the continent? I feel like the technology is helping create and democratize access, but at the same time, it's also very disruptive and it's very new. In my opinion, I think artists also are losing their sense of individuality because of being exposed to so much, you know?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. You know, I'm not a digital evangelist. Let me firstly say that. I think I'm, you know, in responding to the question, one could go for an obvious A-list artist and everyone will smile and be happy and be affirmed. But I think there's often artists out there making things in ways that one doesn't anticipate and doing things with that media in ways that are probably, let me take a concrete example rather than speak abstractly. You know, if one looks at the painters that came out of Kinshasa, Congo, so like Cherry Samba, trained as a sign writer, and then started painting, but bringing that very graphic skill to painting, but producing these extraordinary, imaginative, sometimes quite surreal images that had narrative. If you look at the digital, it's much the same. There's, you know, you can have graphic skills, you can be an illustrator, you can, etc., and you can harness that and you can go work for brands and probably work in advertising and have a successful career. But what happens if you make that same decision as Cherry Samba, that you're going to utilize these skills in digital illustration or sound design, whatever, and somehow try create an artistic experience. So I've seen some of that happening in, let's say, Nairobi. There was just a band, and they're like whole group, the sort of that satellites around them. And it often, you know, it sits uncomfortably close to, let's say, commercial illustration. Hence, you know, like the art world, the formal or high art world, not liking street art. They're seeing it as too close to kind of just illustration. And yet it has a huge sort of audience. And you see the same thing, I would argue, across the African continent. Huge interest in pop culture and pop graphics. And how, you know, when does it step away from that? And when does it become art? I don't know, but I'm interested in that journey.
Yeah, that makes two of us. I'm very interested to see how this all accumulates and adds up in the coming years, especially with...
I suppose, you know, just to end, because I know you need to wrap it tidily, but often these things happen in a sort of chaos, and then a curator comes along and composes it. And the reason I put it that way is a couple of years ago, the Guggenheim in New York had an exhibition of outstanding YouTube videos from the past decade. And someone would have had to go look and find examples of what is outstanding work and organize or curate them. So, you know, I suppose one should worry less about making sense of it in the immediate present, but be mindful that there will be someone that will take an interest and go, huh, you know, what were the best examples of this? And how do you organize it? And what histories does it speak to? And what did it, you know, also what did it create going forward? You know, I think in Ghana, I've seen a number of art historians are very interested in the movie posters that were painted, the one-off sort of paintings from the, I think, the 80s and 90s. Yeah. And, you know, I was once in Kais, which is a small sort of market town in western Mali. And I'd written about design, and I was particularly fascinated by the visual culture with the trucks and all the motifs and symbols that appeared on there. You know, some of them had to do with football. So you'd have like the Cameroonian, very obvious, their national symbol. But then there were also like farm scenes and stuff. And it was that we surrounded by visual culture. I suppose the role of a curator is to draw those things together and point to good examples, examples that connect to longer histories. And also examples that are generative and may not necessarily, let's say, be art, but were highly influential on artists coming. And I suppose that's what the digital offers, I would argue, in a very optimistic sense.
If there were any like aspiring artists who are listening to us, or if there are any artists that are looking to get into the space, what's a piece of advice you would give someone just to like,
I think don't be daunted by the steepness of the road ahead. You know, self-belief is important, and it doesn't self-belief isn't necessarily about being the loudest person in a room. It's just believing in the integrity of what you're doing, sticking at it methodically, actually celebrating your victories along the way. I think very often ambition is very important, but sometimes ambition can make you forget that the journey is the thing, and to celebrate the little milestones along the way. So, you know, what would those milestones be? It might be meeting someone that could be influential to your career and just striking up a conversation with them. Just the conversation itself is enough. It doesn't matter necessarily about the outcome. You know, I think being a part of the art world is being a part of the conversation. And that means having your your own opinions about what other artists are doing, you know, being generous enough to see what other people are doing, not just only pushing your own practice the whole time. Yes, it's important to do that, but I think it's important to be to recognize that you're part of a community. And, you know, I'm often struck by young artists that are successful. They come out of a community. They might be the brightest light in that community, but that, you know, that's, you can't engineer. But it's the fact that you recognize that the conversations that happen amongst your peer group help you develop. Maybe too many bits of advice there. Don't be awed by the steepness of the road ahead. Celebrate your victories. Secondly, and thirdly, be a part of the conversation.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time, Sean. This has been an incredible conversation. I'm personally touched by your experience that you've shared and the nuggets that you've dropped. I look forward to seeing your section at the upcoming fair and look forward to being a part of it.
I look forward to giving you a personal walk.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and thank you so much for your time once again today.
Thank you. We'll talk about Pretoria. We'll get
yes, that. Yes, yes. Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Jude.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye, bye-bye.
Ciao, Jude.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for being a part of this captivating exploration through the Investec Cape Town Art Fair curated series. We trust that you found inspiration and insight in the diverse world of artistic expression showcased in this episode. Looking ahead, the 2024 edition of the Investec Cape Town Art Fair would unfold under the theme Unbound. Save the dates as we eagerly anticipate the 11th edition of this remarkable event from February 16th to 18th, 2024. Stay tuned for more engaging episodes on Jude's List.